Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories making news across South Sudan and the region this Wednesday, October 25th, 2023. A UN Security Council team touches down in Juba for an up-close view of what's happening with the peace deal and met with Riek Machar yesterday.
We have discussed the lifting of the arms embargo and also the sanctions, the state sanctions and the individual sanctions. We have discussed also the process for conducting elections and humanitarian situation in South Sudan.
And activists say it's high time South Sudanese women run for office in South Sudan ahead of next year's elections.
It is not early to start this conversation, as we all know that remaining transitional period is very short.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A United Nations Security Council delegation is in Juba to assess the implementation of South Sudan's revitalized peace agreement. The team, which is set to meet with various stakeholders to the peace deal today, already met with First Vice President Riek Machar and Cabinet Affairs Minister Martin Elia Lomoro yesterday, as we hear from Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The head of the UN Security Council delegation, Michelle Xavier Biang, told the UN-run Radio Miraya that, along with assessing the South Sudan peace deal, the group is in the South Sudanese capital to learn more about the impact of the UN sanctions regime on South Sudan. Pork Both Baluang, acting press secretary in the first vice president's office, says the Security Council delegation and Riek Machar discussed several items.
We have discussed the lifting of the arms embargo and also the sanctions, the state sanctions and the individual sanctions. We have discussed also the process for conducting elections and humanitarian situation in South Sudan.
Baluang says the UN Security Council Committee and Machar also discussed drafting the country's permanent constitution and implementing security arrangements as stipulated in the 2018 peace deal.
He also said that the security arrangement is not only the the graduation and deployment of the forces, also includes creating civic and a political space, and also grant all the rights for the people of South Sudan.
A message posted on the Twitter account of the Reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or RJMEC, Monday said Biang met with the team. The tweet said RJMEC Chief of Staff Berhanu Kebede briefed the delegation on the status of the peace deal and that Kebede gave a detailed update on the status of the R-axis, challenges facing the implementation, and highlighted critical pending tasks as outlined in the roadmap. The UN delegation is expected to travel to the Upper Nile State capital Malakal to meet with internally displaced persons. The team is also scheduled to meet with civil society activists in Juba. Some South Sudanese rights activists say the visit will help push the peace deal's implementation forward, which is far behind schedule. Suara Nelson Loboka, executive director of Action 54, a local human rights group in South Sudan, says if he gets a chance to speak with the UN team, he will urge them to tell the country's leaders to improve security across the country.
Nothing can happen in South Sudan when there is insecurity. But everything in the peace agreement will take place or will happen or will be easily implemented when there is a good security in South Sudan. And as a UN member state, I would ask the UN Security Council Committee to help South Sudan to move to a level where security is prioritized and security prevails everywhere across the country.
Bol Deng, executive director of Intrepid South Sudan, another rights organization, says the Security Council should exert more pressure on the parties to fully implement the deal and do it now, not later.
Give them a strict deadline, is to strictly follow the implementation up, calling on the implementing authorities and also, you know, ahead of time, tell them that there cannot be any more chances.
For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Udo in Juba.
Women activists are calling on women across the country to take part in the upcoming elections, and not just as voters, but as contestants for high-profile positions in government. They say women should start organizing themselves now so they can own the electoral process. Demo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
Women leaders made remarks in Juba today during a two-day annual conference on women, peace and security. Jacqueline Natepo of the IF organization says it is high time women take a front seat in the country's politics and participate in all electoral processes to help bring about a peaceful transition and an inclusive democracy in South Sudan.
It is not early to start this conversation, as we all know that remaining transitional period is very short. Women need to participate in the permanent constitution-making process.
This year's National Women Conference on Peace and Security is being held under the theme Building Inclusive Democracy. It aims to convince women to run for leadership positions so they can help lead the country towards a democratic transition. National Interior Minister Angelina Teng says women need to join political parties and play an active role in clarifying their positions on security matters and other top issues.
So we need to now think consciously, how are we going to be part of all these instruments and mechanisms that are going to be involved in ensuring a safe environment for all the women and all those who aspire to be elected to campaign without fear or favor?
Teng notes that few women participated in the electoral process during the last general election in 2010. Marjan Sipers, the Netherlands ambassador to South Sudan, says she believes South Sudanese women have the potential to move the country into an inclusive democracy.
When I look at the legislative process for the upcoming elections, women are a force to reckon with, and that is a big win. It requires a continuous fight, but it works. I have seen strong women leaders go stronger and overcome the political challenges that they face. I have seen in them a new type of leadership needed for the future of South Sudan, namely to start governing this country.
The peace deal sets aside 35% of positions in the legislature, executive and judiciary for women. Aya Benjamin Warile, South Sudan's Minister for Gender, Child and Social Welfare, says the country is in a critical moment of transition and that women leaders are needed to build an inclusive government.
It is an opportunity for all of us here as women to really look at what is happening in the surrounding and how we can seriously participate in making this country a better place for all of us, more peaceful, more inclusive, and how we can also participate in the development.
Over the next 2 days, women are also expected to discuss the challenges hindering women participation in leadership and the benefits of having women in political leadership. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
This week, the war between Sudan's army and the paramilitary group RSF entered its seventh month. 9,000 people have been killed and another 5.6 million people have been forced to flee their homes during the conflict, according to the UN. With most of the world's attention focused now on the Israel-Hamas war, some analysts are concerned about the plight of the vulnerable in Sudan. Abdi Ismail Samatar is a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament. He was also a member of the Pan-African Parliament. He tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that the African Union has not done enough to try to resolve the conflict.
Yeah, you know, when I was in my last meeting at the Pan-African Parliament, the issue of the Sudan came up. And right there, it was clear to me, although the Pan-African Parliament is an advisory body rather than a legislative body, that it was clear that we just don't have the wherewithal, moral or otherwise, to be able to address this question. So what's taking place in particularly in Khartoum, but more broadly in the Sudan, are two people, just like the Somali warlords of the 1990s, and they are the ones who brought Mogadishu to its knees and destroyed the country and the possibility of that country recovering. If the African Union cannot see this coming and where it's going to go, then the African Union itself should be disbanded, because it's a talk shop rather than a shop that brings people together, have an agenda, protect our people, create peace where there's war, to create prosperity where there's poverty. And I just think the African people deserve better than what we have in the form of African Union presently.
Sudanese have been suffering, depending on international aid groups to feed them and to give them medical care. But we've seen countries like Rwanda send aid to Gaza.
Whether we agree with the Paul Kagame or not in terms of democracy and all of that jazz, it's very clear that Rwanda has got its act together. Its children are going to good schools. The economy seems to be working very well, and so on and so forth. So if they have the generosity of the spirit to see that they can provide food aid for sort of the people of Gaza, well, then I will say to that. That doesn't mean, therefore, Rwanda should not also take the leadership in addressing what's happening in the Sudan, and particularly in Khartoum and in Darfur. And I think that should become a model for the rest of Africans. The Ethiopian government should be doing that. The Egyptian government should be doing that next door to them. Algerians should be doing that. The Nigerians, the South Africans. I spoke in that Pan-African Parliament meeting in May, and I said we should be able, if each and every country was able to donate $15, $20 million. For many countries, $20 million is not a lot of money. We could do a great deal to secure Khartoum. And if we secure Khartoum, the rest of the Sudan will fall into place. But it seems to me the quality of leadership in our continent at the level of the presidency or the premiership is not there to be able to address this. And therefore, we begin to complain and then beg.
There are some who have blamed the fighting in Sudan between the two generals on foreign interests. Do you buy that argument?
Whether we like it or not, foreign interests, they are going to get their licks in our continent, whether we like it or not, whether we want it or not. The question is not whether there's going to be an influence in there. I'm sure Israel is involved in that. Basically, with the U.S. government, it was able to convince the previous regime to sort of recognize Israel and have a sort of a diplomatic relations with it. So, yes, it was there. But the question is, we can blame all we want to others. The question is, this is our continent, this is our people. And therefore, can we stand up to be counted? I mean, if we were able to have a standing army of about 15 to 20,000, the whole continent should be able to support that. ECOWAS is able to do that some of the time. And then we send these to places where there are horrific humanitarian crises, such as Khartoum in the Sudan. We are unable to do that. So blaming others for getting involved in this, well, that's the nature of politics in the contemporary world. They will get their licks in there if we don't have ours.
That is Abdi Ismail Samatar. He's professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali Parliament. He was speaking with my colleague, Douglas Mpuga. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, the balancing act of U.S. President Biden on supporting Israel and the call to protect civilians in Gaza. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. As talk of an Israeli ground invasion on Gaza continues, U.S. President Joe Biden is facing the challenges of balancing unwavering support for America's closest ally in the Middle East with international demands for more robust protections for civilians in Gaza and Israeli restraint to avoid a broader war in the Middle East. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Squara reports.
As airstrikes in Gaza continue, President Joe Biden has been urging Israel to consider the consequences of what Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu calls its mighty vengeance on Hamas.
Are you encouraging the Israelis to delay invasion?
It's part of Biden's push to buy more time to secure delivery of much-needed aid for civilians, the extraction of several hundred Palestinian Americans trapped in Gaza, and hostage negotiations. Four hostages, including two Americans, have been released from among the more than 200 people that Israeli officials say were abducted by Hamas during its coordinated attacks on Israeli soil on October 7th that killed at least 1,400 people.
The attacks by Hamas did not happen in a vacuum. The Palestinian people have been subjected to 56 years of suffocating occupation.
Those remarks by United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres at the UN Security Council on Tuesday prompted criticism from Gilad Erdan, Israeli ambassador to the UN.
The UN is failing, and you, Mr. Secretary General, have lost all morality and impartiality.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, also at the Security Council on Tuesday, warned Tehran against widening the war as Israel braces for more attacks from Iran-backed groups such as Hezbollah in Lebanon that are likely to intensify once Israel begins its ground invasion. Blinken delivered a forceful defense of Israel's military actions, but issued the administration's strongest urging to Israel so far to avoid harm to civilians.
It means food, water, medicine, and other essential humanitarian assistance must be able to flow into Gaza and to the people who need them.
The White House clarifies the humanitarian pause that Blinken called for is not the same as a ceasefire, which National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says will only benefit Hamas right now.
This is war. It is combat. It is bloody. It is ugly. And it's going to be messy. And innocent civilians are going to be hurt going forward.
Since October 7, Israeli airstrikes have killed more than 5,000 people in Gaza, according to the Hamas-controlled Ministry of Health, and displaced more than a million people. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire to facilitate the release of all hostages and to ease what he calls the epic suffering of civilians in Gaza. While he has repeatedly condemned the attack on Israel, Guterres said yesterday it is important to also recognize that the Hamas attack did not happen in a vacuum, telling the Security Council the Palestinian people have been subjected to 56 years of suffocating occupation and that their land has been, quote, steadily devoured by settlements and plagued by violence. Edmond Garib, professor of Middle East history at the American University in Washington, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi why the council could reach a resolution on a humanitarian ceasefire.
The Security Council is, to a certain extent, is paralyzed. It's very difficult for them to act unless there is at least some understanding or common stand between these powers. Therefore, what we are seeing now is this paralysis and the inability of the Security Council of the United Nations to do what is needed, which is bring an end to the fighting, bring an end to the suffering of people on all sides, especially what we are seeing in Gaza, one of the most densely populated areas in the world, is under attack by a far superior force. Of course, the attacks on civilians that took place in Israel also one cannot justify or support, but you cannot support or justify also a far worse number of casualties and suffering among the population.
Crown Prince and Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, called for the establishment of a Palestinian state based on 1967 border, and he said the conditions must be created for the return of stability and the achievement of a lasting peace that will ensure a just solution to establish a Palestinian state in order to achieve security and prosperity for all. Is that still feasible?
I think the dangerous situation that exists on the ground is already basically alerting many countries to the dangers accompanying the inability to grant the Palestinians their rights on their own land and the right to establish their own state. Even here we've seen in the New York Times an article by Thomas Friedman. Basically, he was urging and beseeching the White House to return to the policy of the two-state solution, and that there should be a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza next to Israel, and that that is the best way to make sure that we don't see constant eruptions of violence, of fighting every few years, in addition to the daily incidents that take place. What was interesting also that we heard from Freeman and his article is that the U.S. government should pressure the Israeli government to pull out the settlers from the West Bank.
That was Edmund Garib, professor of Middle East history at the American University here in Washington, on why the UNSC was unable to approve a resolution on a humanitarian ceasefire. He was speaking to my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawi. UNESCO says Africa continues to experience a shortage of teachers in many schools due to an increased number of students seeking education and the lack of enough resources to improve the education sector. The UN agency says the continent needs at least 15 million teachers to teach primary and secondary students by 2030 in order to address the shortage. Mohammed Youssef has this report.
Africa has successfully enrolled more students in class in the past decade, but the quality of education has been questioned due to teacher shortages in many African schools. The United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, says despite some gains in the past 5 years in teacher recruitment, progress has been slow and many countries need to increase the number of teachers they recruit yearly. Patrick Nkengne is a senior education analyst at UNESCO. He says a small number of teachers are attending to millions of students in Africa.
When a classroom welcomes more than 100 students instead of the about 50 students it was built for, or as opposed to a ratio of 40 to 50 students per teacher recommended by the norm and standard, it clearly shows a shortage. As the number of classrooms in these conditions increases, the issues of shortages becomes acute.
For Africa to reach its education goals, UNESCO says the continent has to recruit at least 15 million teachers by 2030, both in primary and secondary schools. The agency said the Central African Republic, Chad, Mali and Niger will need the highest number of primary teachers with 6% or more growth annually. In secondary education, higher annual growth in teacher numbers is needed in many African countries. Emmanuel Manyasa is an education expert based in Kenya. He says many schools are producing uneducated children due to the lack of teachers.
So you have both dissatisfied teachers and dissatisfied learners. The learners aren't getting the attention and the support they need. The teachers are overwhelmed by the big numbers and the long hours of teaching, which don't even give them time to prepare for lessons, so they come to class unprepared, disenfranchising learners even more. And eventually, our schools just become growth centers where children go to grow, with very little learning happening there.
Some experts blame financial constraints and the few resources available are not utilized, leading to a waste of resources. In countries with enough teachers, Nkengne says, they struggle to provide quality education to the learners due to poor teacher qualifications.
In a normal situation, a teacher must be adequately equipped to care of the students so that they effectively acquire knowledge at school. Unfortunately, it was demonstrated that in many cases, a considerable number of those who are supposed to play the role of teachers does not even have the mastery of the subject they are supposed to teach. In those cases, students cannot learn because basically they don't have a teacher in front of them. Those cases are not easy to identify. To do so, system needs to make teacher pass a test.
Experts say there are not enough resources to conduct tests to check the educational knowledge of teachers. Manyasa says teachers need to be encouraged to work hard to reach areas to bridge the gap of those not getting an education.
We need to be able to make sure there is fair distribution of the teachers across the country. And with that goes the issue of how do we incentivize teachers to work in areas that are generally not preferred. Mostly they are not preferred because of harsh climatic conditions, sometimes because of perennial insecurity problems, sometimes because of the fact that they are rural. So how do we incentivize teachers to work in those areas so that we can improve the distribution of the teachers across the country? I think that that is critical.
UNESCO is urging African governments to assess the anticipated teacher requirements for the next 3 to 10 years, reflect on an initial training approach that can produce the necessary number of teachers, and ensure adequate resources for the recruitment and training of additional educators. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
As the world seeks strong leadership to find solutions to its many social, political, and economic crises, Africa is celebrating 50 young individuals who are making a difference on the continent. They have been named global changemakers at an African youth summit in Rawsonville, South Africa. Vicky Stark was there and has sent us this report.
These young men and women have been recognized for having a big positive impact on their communities. And organizers of the African Youth Summit say they hope the youths will return home to inspire others to do the same. Gabriela Yeager, who co-founded the Global Changemakers organization, says about 1,250 young people have been selected since the organization was launched 15 years ago. They are given training, mentorship, networking opportunities, and funding. Yeager says they are assisting 460 youth-led projects around the world with an estimated impact on 16 million people.
Personally, I believe that the grassroots work these young people are doing is immensely important, not only in terms of the results that the project itself is having, but also to show other young people that it's important to become active, that they can have an impact in their communities.
Lukhanyo Sonyamba of South Africa is one of the new global changemakers, selected from almost 5,000 entrants. Already an advisor to his government's Children's Commissioner, Sonyamba is hoping this new distinction will further his mission to help young people bridge intergenerational challenges in the workplace.
There's many instances where I've actually had to speak with my other co-workers and try to find that middle ground where we actually come to a consensus like, okay, I know that I'm younger than you and you're older than me and you've been doing this quite for a long time, but when you are wrong, I will address you in this manner respectfully, and when I'm wrong, address me respectfully.
Becoming a global changemaker in 2016 has made a massive difference to nutrition advocate Maureen Muketha of Kenya, who's at the summit as a facilitator. She founded Tule Vyema, which is Swahili for Let's Eat Right. It encourages young women to cultivate indigenous gardens for their household consumption and sell the surplus. So far, Muketha has reached 900 households.
Global Changemakers has equipped me with the necessary skills in terms of how to do fundraising, but also how to do proposal writing.
For the first time this year, Atia Kafia, an organization in South Africa that traditionally promotes the Afrikaans language and culture, partnered with Global Changemakers. Atia Kafia's managing director, Sanal Britt, says they hosted the summit at one of their holiday resorts called Houdini Spa and will provide funding for some of the projects of the South African participants. Britt says during the four-day summit from October 17th to 20th, the new global changemakers learned skills and listened to panel discussions and lectures on a range of topics, including tech, politics, and finance.
What happens for them after this is that they have the opportunity to actually write business plans, to submit their proposals, and to obtain possible funding to implement all of these projects in their communities.
Global Changemakers is looking for partners to host next year's summit in Mexico for Latin America and the Latin community in North America. Vicky Stark, VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
Remix. And And that's our show for this Wednesday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with a song, The Balumba Remix by Bebe Philip and Eddie Kenzo. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Jumbe Hamza, and producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. Hallelujah.